Our next guest, who also, I think, in the dictionary may be listed under the definition of tenacity. She's a fairly driven person, and I think her story is full of some of the secrets to success. Let's hear a little bit more about her profile.
Amberine Musa is the founder and CEO of SouqAlMal.com, a comparison website where people can compare personal loans, credit cards, mortgages, school fees, and much more. Originally from Mauritius, Amberine holds an undergraduate business degree from RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. She started her first online business, an online property portal for international students to Australia, at the age of 21. Moving to London in 2004 to work for General Electric's financial arm, GE Money, Amberine had various roles including marketing, financial literacy, and e-commerce. She led the first online financial literacy initiative in the UK, moneybasics.co.uk. Moving to the Middle East in 2008, Amberine worked as a consultant for Bain & Company Middle East and focused on financial services projects, such as growth strategies for banks in the region. She moved on to set up the consulting arm of MasterCard Middle East and Africa, where she stayed for 2 years before founding SouqAlMal in 2011. Amberine Musa holds an MBA from INSAD and is the co-author of Entrepreneurial Opportunities in the Internet in 2006.
Well, welcome to Ion Careers, Amberine.
My pleasure.
It's, I guess I've known you for quite some time, and so I actually kind of watched you launch SouqAlMal.com, and it's been a sprawling success. I think, how many staff do you have now?
We're now 14 staff, and we're going on to 22 by the end of the year.
Wow, that's, mabrouk to you, mashallah.
It's growing fast, but I have to admit, it's exciting, and it's adrenaline rush, and I think, we're doing well. I'm very excited about this year.
I find the hardest thing, you know, in being an entrepreneur is you can't just be good at accounting or just marketing or just sales or people management or HR and so on. You have to be doing everything all the time. And is that one of the challenges, being able to shift gears on a dime and use different parts of your brain from 1 minute, and at the same time use that part of your brain at, 100% full speed?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think that comes out really a lot when you first start, because you're alone. It's either you can be you and yourself, or you and someone else. And so basically you become, or you're generally, entrepreneurs are generally all-rounders. They are kind of good at a lot of different things, but master of none, really. So eventually what you do is you start building the right people around you. I think one of the best skills is to identify good people around you, to bring them together, and so then you can start delegating different parts of the business. But at the beginning, yes. I mean, today I still do my financials myself. When I first started SouqAlMal.com, it was everything from sales to marketing to PR, which I didn't really know I could do. I didn't even know I was not bad at PR, and I still do my PR today at in the business. So yes, you do need that tenacity. And there's one thing my dad used to tell me when I was thinking of starting up the business was, be aware, it is a 24/7 thing, and you've got your hands in absolutely every single part in the business. I was like, yeah, that's fine. I can deal with that. And thinking about it today, it is a 24/7. It's, you never get any time off, and it's not even, you don't even have a holiday, because at this point of time where the business is in that growth stage where it is, holiday or not, you're still working. You're not reporting to anybody except for yourself. So when you don't work, the business doesn't grow.
So this concept of balance is a fallacy for the top performer.
To be honest, we had a chat about it with a few kind of colleagues today in terms of balance, life balance as an entrepreneur. I think it's tough. It's definitely, starting up a business is probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do, especially now that I've got two kids. One of them is 3.5 years old and the other one is 4 months old.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. It's definitely one of the hardest things. And do I have a life balance at the moment? Probably not at this stage. I have to say something has to give.
That's PC for hell no.
Absolutely. But I think one thing you have to realize, if you do decide to become an entrepreneur, it's not an easy road. You need to be really, really passionate about it. You need, as you mentioned earlier on, Shane, you need to have the tenacity, the perseverance. You will meet people along the way, and I did, who told me, what are you wasting your time for? You'll never succeed. This will never grow. This business is a failure.
Who says that?
I've had investors saying
that. Oh, investors. Yeah.
People we approach right at the start. So people will tell you these things, and it's a matter of how much do you believe in what you're doing. And even if you don't know whether this will really succeed, it doesn't matter. At least give it a try. But one thing you have to remember, it is a hard... It's a hard road ahead, and something has to give. You cannot have it all. And I know that, you know, we are, when we're young, at the age of 21, 22, you think you're a superwoman and you can do it all, until you actually do get through different stages of life and you start having kids and you realize actually something has got to give. And in my case, unfortunately, I try to spend as much time as I can with the kids, but it does, some days it does suffer. I don't see them a lot some days, and I try and catch up on the weekend.
I have one individual who's a self-made billionaire, and he said, you know, I was just working, and then I'm coming home, and I'm going to go see my one-year-old son, and, you know, expecting him to come, you know, so excited to see dad come walking through the room. And then when I walked in the house, he thought someone was breaking in. He didn't know who I was, and he didn't recognize that it's his dad. And then he went on to have a heart attack at the age of 45. And he said,
"Are you trying to scare me?"
Yeah, this is what he said, you know. But you know, and what he said, you know, Shane, it's funny when you are on your back, when they say your life flashes before your eyes, it really does. And what I realized was none of my business partners came to see me, and the only people who came around were my family. And he said the ridiculous thing was I was trying to make the billion to make my family happy, and my family were only supporting me to make the billion because they thought it was making me happy. And you don't need $1 billion to hang out with your family. So he said, right after the heart attack, he stepped away from the business, and now Hank spends a lot of time with them. But it's a funny conundrum.
It is, but at the same time, you know what they say, too much of something is always bad. So I think there is always a moderation at a level to give. I'm hoping, and I don't think I'll be having a heart attack anytime soon. Things have to get give. There's one thing I do keep is fitness, and I try and keep that on, whether it's 7 a.m. in the morning or whether it's kind of rushing out for an hour during working hours. You find time. It's very interesting how. It was a discipline that I put myself in the last 3 months, going, I've got to get back into fitness. I can't keep doing it. If I'm going to be working that many hours and I'm going to try and be home with the kids and something has to change. And as much as I thought this will never happen because I will never have time, as an entrepreneur as well, you do learn. You learn how to make time. You learn how to be productive. You learn how to be extremely efficient. It's getting easier and easier as my team grows, though. As the team grows, you can delegate more and more of the stuff you used to do. And interestingly enough is when you start delegating, you start trusting people, which is a very hard thing to do. And you ask any entrepreneur out there, one of the hardest part is, how do you find the right person to delegate the work to? You've been doing this for 2 years on your own. You know how to do it. It takes you 30 seconds versus going to train up someone to do it. But once you pass that level of training and you get someone you can trust, it is the most amazing feeling in the world because you can finally take a step back.
Right. But, you know, when you're a startup, it's also really difficult. You know, how do you attract good people? Because good people want to work like you did. You wanted to work for GE when you started. You wanted to work for MasterCard. You didn't want to work for, let's have a meeting at my kitchen table. We're doing a startup. It's going to be cool.
No, you're absolutely right. I wanted to work for my own startup and nobody else's startup. Absolutely correct. And I think that's probably one of the hardest and the biggest challenge any startup has in this region is, how do you find the right talent? What we've seen is it's getting easier and easier. As our brand name is quite well established in the UAE, it is easier to attract the talent, but you need to have some structure in place as well. The good people that you want are the ones who will probably want to go to the Fortune 500 companies and the multinational companies. How do you move them over? You need to show them the passion. And what we've done is to show them the passion and the vision of the business. Once, if you manage to sell your business and the vision of the business of what is going to be in the next 4 to 5 years to someone, if they've got the entrepreneurial spirit, they will be convinced. Part of what we've done as well is we have stock options for our employees as well. So those who we cannot afford, who are too expensive for us to afford, we do give a combination of cash and equity. And when you have that kind of combination, you're flexible around that, people do get attracted, because then they see the vision, they see that they are part of the founding team, they're part of the success story, and they are going to be getting something out of it if this company is successful.
Right, and the legal structures, though, in the Middle East, it makes it difficult for you to give the equity. You know, do you actually have it? So, you know, if someone's going to have equity in the business, and their name has to be on the registration document, and when you're actually doing some transactions, you need sign-off from all these people versus, you know, back in the West where you can just give shares or give non-management shares or et cetera, et cetera. Well, how did you tackle that?
No, so the way you do as a stock option. So basically, the way the company is structured is we have a company here in GLT, but there is a BVI company that owns 100% of the GLT company. So all shareholders, all investors are all based out of the BVI, which is very clear-cut, very black and white in terms of regulations. And when it comes to employees, you give them stock options. So basically, when you have stock options, is we don't need the signature of every single stock option holder to do anything with the business. It's not about having rights to the decisions of the company. It's about having financial rights. So whenever an exit happens or whenever you start to sell the business, they get part of the financial upside, but nothing else.
This is Ion Careers, the career clinic, charting your next move.
Right now, we're listening to Amberine Moussa, who's the founder and chief executive officer of SouqAlMal.com. She's previously worked with General Electric, Bain & Company, MasterCard. She has had a very successful corporate career and a successful career as an entrepreneur, but it wasn't always like that. Starting out, it was challenging. She comes from the island of Mauritius and not necessarily a talent pool that GE, Bain & Company, and MasterCard generally pull talent from. So let's hear how she started climbing that ladder. Amberine, welcome back to Ion Careers.
Yes, thanks for having me. First of all, Shane, it's always a pleasure to be on in the studio with you. How it all started, so I left, as you just mentioned, I was born and brought up in Mauritius and did my high school. And I come from a family, quite a conservative family, where girls going overseas for the studies wasn't the norm. And I knew that. And I kind of made up my mind very early on that it was going to happen, though. So I worked really, really hard and managed to get a scholarship to go to Australia to study. So once the scholarship was there, my parents were very much, you know what, if you're going to do it well. So in 97, I landed in Australia, Melbourne. Did my degree for 4 years. But post the degree, the fact that I don't have a residency in Australia, you can't really stay. And tried to look for jobs, but because of the residency status, they had to prove why an Australian couldn't get a job and why they had to give it to me. It was very, very, very tough. Eventually landed up with General Electric. And at some point, I was like, well, if I don't want to leave here and I don't want to go back to Mauritius, I'm going to have to make sure I get a job, no matter what it takes. So I called in GE, who was my last resort. Pretty much, it was the last company that was
left. This is in Australia?
In Australia, in Melbourne. And they said the same story. They're like, look, you don't have a residency. You can't stay here. It's going to take us too long to get your job. And I finally said, look, you have to give me a chance here.
So okay. They said no, you oh, called
they
back. No. They said no, you called back.
They
how many times
no.
did you call them after
Probably
they said
around
no?
Probably 5 times. And they kept saying no. And finally, I just rocked up. And I said, look, here's my CV. I know I have an amazing CV. And you can't let me go. You will regret this. And I can promise you, if you take me in...
You will regret this.
If you take me in, you will not regret the decision. I would take any job you have, but let me in. And and she laughed. I remember very well the HR person going, you are persistent. And I said, I want you guys to consider me. No matter what it is, just take me in, consider me, and I can do a very good job. So they came back. They said, you know what? Actually, we can have you as a contractor. That's an option. But 3 days a week. And we don't really know what you're going to do, but just come in. We kind of, someone needs an assistant. One of the senior guys needed someone to kind of work with him. And
so it was like an assistant, like answering phones?
No, it was more like kind of a right-hand person. Nobody really knew what the job was. It was kind of someone to help him do presentations or do some research. He didn't really know himself. He just landed his job himself from the US, and he kind of needed someone on his side. So started the job with him for 3 days a week, and I wasn't even an employee of GE at the time. They put me on some contracting job with Hayes, I think it was at the time, it's one of the recruitment company.
Okay, so you're a temp, yep.
Yep, a temp. 3 days a week. I was extremely ecstatic. This for me, and I mean, if I look back, it's not a great job, but for me, I was ecstatic. And I worked hard. Couple of weeks later, my boss came to me and said, you know what, I'm actually very impressed. We can offer you a full-time job. And it was easier for them to show the immigration department that I've been a temp for a while, and it was a job.
How long did that take?
It took 3 weeks.
It
was 3 weeks. They were convinced. They were like coming on board full time. Because what I did as well is I didn't just sit there and take whatever was given to me. And so while trying to do God knows what he wanted me to do, presentations and research, I kind of built a role for myself, and I kind of made him very dependent on me in terms of what he wanted to. And I think both of us were trying to find our feet as well. So we both kind of tried our feet together and eventually came up with a program that we could have done, which was a cross-selling program, and which meant I was responsible then to start moving clients from one GE business to another. And I started working with the different MDs of the business and trying to put them together. And again, with my e-commerce background, I actually built an online platform for them, which they didn't even have to outsource, they didn't even pay for it because it was all my time, build an online platform for them so they could talk to each other and have all the leads captured, where they could actually share the leads and different customers among the
businesses. So you were programming this?
Or? I was, yeah.
Okay, so you have a certain skill set.
I did have a certain skill set that came out very useful, if you want. So that job came out very, very interesting, and that's how it kind of all... You know, the ball kept rolling, and from there, then with my online background, they shipped me off to London and dropped me into the financial services industry. I knew nothing about credit card. I didn't even own a credit card at the time. Got me into financial services industry and told me, look, we don't have anybody who understands digital. It was 2004. It was kind of something new for GE. They're a brick and mortar company. They are an industrial company. And why don't you help us out? And they said, look, we need to launch these brands out in the UK. We'd have no branches, and you understand digital, and the only way to do this is online. And so I took up the challenge again. Nobody really knew what the job was, yet again. And I have to say, I think last time we had the conversation was about, you know, do you go for the role that is got a very strong job description, that it's very boxed in, very comfortable, though, tells you exactly what you need to do? Or do you go for the role that is very vague? Nobody really knows what it is. What I find interesting about the roles that are quite vague is you can make up your own role eventually. You make up your own job. You make up your own KPIs, and you make up your own career. And that was very exciting. And I think, and it's very entrepreneurial. You make it from scratch. You build it.
You drive it. I mean, but you're constantly going above and beyond, and you're very determined. You're not scared of getting rejection. You're not scared of failure. And I think a lot of the people nowadays, they forgot what a telephone was. You know, like before they had email, people would call people and you would meet with people. And they're spending their whole job search sending emails, and that's just not going to work. Like, if you're listening to this right now,
or cover letters.
Or generic it's cover obsolete. Letters. Dear ma'am, sir, this is not going to work. And emails aren't going to work. You need to get in front of someone who can give you a job. That's what you did.
Because don't forget as well, that person now has an email in an email box, and it's got 200 emails a day. They've got candidates all over the place all day long trying to get the attention on an email. It doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
You kind of go back to a traditional way.
And the other catch is, though, if you spend an hour and a half in front of your computer answering emails and doing your typing work or whatever, when someone's there to see you, you know, that 10 minutes, it's actually a welcome break from the monotony of typing away.
Absolutely. And you put a face to a name. You can assess someone very quickly when they come and meet you. And just the fact of someone coming to meet you for a job versus trying to email you shows the perseverance of it.
And I think even if they, stop me from doing something, you know, if I'm in the middle of something and for whatever reason I find them annoying, deep down inside, I still do recognize their determination. Like you say, okay, you know, at least they're determined, they have tenacity. But as well, if it's paired with intelligence, like, you know, they know who you are, they know what your business is about. You know, it's just not some random
do your research.
Bull. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the key part. And it's interesting you say that, Shane. We've been hiring a lot in the last year or so, and I think I've gone through 150 interviews of different people, and you can see in the first 5 minutes the guys who've got the brains, but also has got this tenacity. You've also meet people who've got the brains, but has zero passion or enthusiasm in life, and one without the other doesn't work.
It's always amazing, though. You know, you see someone with a tier one business school degree, no ambition, no drive, no focus, and they go nowhere.
No, because without passion, without drive, nobody wants you. They want that passion. They want people, when they hire you, they want to see that you're a self-motivator, that you've got energy. And that's what people are looking for. You've got the energy, you've got the self-starter mode. They don't have to hold your hand. Because especially in smaller companies and environments where it is extremely important for you to be quite independent and for you to drive your own agenda and drive your own career versus holding your hand and telling you at every step of the way what you need to do.
So, you know, just fast forward here, you end up going to INSEAD, which, you know, we won't hold that against you, but nevertheless, you
decided. I'm not sure why you should either. It was the best year of my life by far.
No, it's a great school. But you decided then to go to test the waters in investment banking. And out of all the students, even the ones who have banking experience, of which you had no banking experience, you were able to get an internship at the infamous Goldman Sachs. Can you tell us what your process was to make that happen?
That was an extremely interesting process. So I started at INSEAD in January 2007. The way it works is if you want an internship by July, you better get on it. The banks come on campus 3 weeks later as you start your MBA. So the first semester for me was kind of complete wipe off. I didn't have a single finance background. I had economics and accounting, but I didn't have investment banking background. And generally, if you want an internship in investment banking, you kind of need to have some sort of M&A background behind you. So I kind of wondered, how am I ever going to do that? There were 450 students at INSEAD, and I can tell you half of them were looking for banking jobs at the time. It was 2008. It was booming. Bonuses were huge. Everybody was attracted towards banking. So I kind of thought, how do I differentiate myself? And I had to have something up my sleeve. What I did, exactly talking about, you know, no emails, go the traditional way. I found people in each of the different investment bank in London. I was based out of Paris at the time, Fontainebleau more specifically, at INSEAD. And through different connections, through cold calling, I found people in one person on the trading desk in each of the banks. I called them up, I set up a time, and I actually took a flight, missed a week of school, took a flight, went to London, and went to sit with each and every one of them throughout a week. Came back to INSEAD, go through my interviews, and I can tell you, one term, and each of my interviews that I did with the investment banks, every time I said, oh yeah, of course, I spent a day on the trading floor, their face changed. The expression on their face just went, what do you mean? So yeah, I found someone that I knew and through contacts, and I spent a day, and that's what I thought, and I'm extremely thrilled, and this is what I learned during the day, and I think I can learn a lot more throughout the 3 months internship with you. It was amazing how that made such a change in the interviewer.
They're like, this girl is serious. She's a lion. Lion. Anyway,
for that change.
This is a story of Ambreen Moussa, founder and CEO of SoukAlMal.com, sharing her insights on the road to the top.
This is Eye on Careers, keeping an eye on your career.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are looking at what it takes to make it to the top. First of all, we heard the story of Raha Muharrak, who's the first Saudi and youngest woman to climb Mount Everest. Her story is full of tips and tricks to get to the top. One of the main takeaways from her story was it's not the physical challenge that's the greatest. It's the mental toughness that you need to do the climb. And I think that's true in your career or whether you're climbing a mountain. And if you missed that, you can catch it on our website, dubaii1038.com/eyeoncareers, and take a look at the podcast. There is a litany of uberly successful people on there telling all about how they did it, how they made it. But right now we're listening to the story of Ambreen Moussa, who's the founder and CEO of SoukAlMal.com. And she started life out in Mauritius, and being the ambitious young woman that she was, she decided she needed to go pursue an education overseas. ended up in Australia. And unfortunately, it was tough to get a job there when she first really didn't have her residency, so they couldn't hire her. And GE rejected her application. She called them back, and they said, sorry. So she called them back again five more times, and they said, sorry. And so then she went down in person and demanded a job, and they gave her a temporary contract job, which she turned into a full-time, and her corporate life takes off. We were just hearing the story about how she got her internship at Goldman Sachs. This is one determined woman. Amberine, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Pleasure, Shane.
And it's funny that, you know, when you look at it, it's not that people lack talent or IQ. They lack drive. They lack will. They lack that commitment to say, you know, how many people will continue to ask for something after they're said they're rejected five times? But psychological studies show that people only start saying, not like, you know, 60-70% of people only start saying yes after they've been asked the same question 5, 6, 7 times.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that one, but no wonder that worked for me then.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually sales theory, right? So if you ask someone to buy, 90% of people say no on the first one. And I think then it gets up to like 60 or 70 start saying yes at 5. And then 90% say yes at 9.
It's all about the perseverance. It's all about being afraid to fail is probably one of the worst things that you can have. And if anybody out there has that, it's something that definitely needs to be worked on. I think we have a motto in the office, which is, and we encourage all our employees to do that, is try it, break it, but then please fix it after.
So you go on, you finish INSEAD, and then what happens after that? You
ended up. I finished INSEAD, and I had a very kind of safe career in GE. When I decided to go to INSEAD, the reason I decided to go to business school was I had this chief marketing officer at GE who I used to work for. She was amazing. She was literally my role model. It was very rare that I saw a woman. She's 37 years old. She was already CMO of GE, and she was incredibly smart, and I really enjoyed working with her. It was she was really incredibly inspiring, and she was Syrian. She was actually funny from the Middle East. It was going to take too long to get there, so I thought I'd go to INSEAD, skip 5 years. So impatience is, I think, one of a big trait of entrepreneurs as well, by the way. Mm. Decided to skip 5 years, so went to INSEAD, thought, I'll come back, I'll do the ECLP program, which is one of the management program at GE, and eventually you become a senior band, as they call it, which is right under the CEO level within a couple of years. But then again, when you go to business school, it's 2008, it was booming. I tried the investment banking during my internship. Money was great, but definitely wasn't for me. I was way too much of an entrepreneur to be stuck on a trading floor, I can tell you that much. So then, post my internship at Goldman Sachs, I had to find another job, and here we go again. So the third semester was, again, another job search, and I landed a job with Bain & Company in the Middle East. And for me, and I had a job in the Middle East, one in Singapore, and another offer in the UK. I'd lived in Australia, in London, in France, in Singapore. I'd done the Asia, and the Middle East was the one place I hadn't been yet. So I decided to pack my bags and come over here. And I have to say, I used to love the life of just living out of a suitcase. It was fantastic. You can just pack your bags and move. It's fantastic. There's no one to ask.
Okay. So you join with Bain, and then do you leave Bain to join MasterCard?
Yeah, so joined Bain for 2 years, learned an extremely enormous amount. And one of the advice I have to admit that I do tell a lot of people, although everybody knows it's not the ideal lifestyle when you're a consultant, especially out of Dubai. You're most of the time not here. You're half the time on a plane. It's exhausting. It's tiring. You don't have a family life. It is probably those 2 years taught me an enormous amount that I use on a daily basis in my job today as an entrepreneur. Interestingly enough, consulting entrepreneurship just doesn't seem to go together. But one of it, the consulting part, was a huge foundation to me being successful as an entrepreneur. It teaches you the structure. So if you have the opportunity to do it right after school, and do it when you're young because you really don't have a life, if you can do it when you're young, those 2 years or even 3 or 4 years, if you can afford it, it is a fantastic base to a successful career, I think. So I did this for 2 years, learned quite a lot. Then I got headhunted by MasterCard to come and set up their consulting arm for Middle East and Africa. So pretty much what I was doing at Bain, but more on very specific projects, which is cards, credit cards projects for the banks, for the clients of MasterCard. So you would go into one of the banks and help them with acquisition strategy from the credit card perspective. We helped a bank kind of come up with a credit card that was profitable from an Islamic point of view. You would help them retain the customers and various different projects such as so very, very much towards acquisition and, sure. And so growing the different banks.
So what was the point where you walked in, you said, that's it, I quit?
So what happened was I felt pregnant, got on maternity leave, and I'm guessing you would know by now that maternity leave for me was kind of getting boring after a while. And so went off and looked at what I could do. And the idea of starting up a comparison site was here since 2008. It was the day I walked into Dubai. I remember very well where I thought it's crazy that nobody has done it. And I called Money Supermarket 3 times. I tried to get in touch with them. MoneySupermarket.com is the comparison website in the UK, the most successful one. These guys are making £200 million a year, and they're worth around £1.1 billion in the stock exchange.
You know, the Dubai duty free, I think I read in December, did $205 million just in that 1 month in gross revenue. What?
That's a lot of
That's
money.
That's amazing. Colm McLaughlin is the man. But sorry.
So no, not at all. So I tried to get Money Supermarket out here as a franchise, and they literally ignored me, as GE did and as everybody else throughout my career.
Because the market's too small. They're like, we're making too much money. We don't care about the Middle East.
It's probably that. They didn't even care to respond. So I wouldn't even be able to tell you why. So I decided, okay, well, if they're not going to do it, I'm going to go do it on my own. And obviously having consulting lifestyle just wasn't possible. So when I moved over to MasterCard and I felt pregnant and I was on maternity leave, kind of made sense to start it. And so I got
so
it started.
You told them you will regret this.
No, I wasn't that harsh. I was a bit more mature at the time. That was kind of the immaturity speaking at the age of 22. So at the age of 30, I was a little bit more mature. And so I decided to start up SukalMal by myself. But the one thing I did was I decided I would do it on the side, not just quit my job and kind of venture myself into something I didn't even know whether it would work, and I didn't even know there was a need. So the way I want to do it is funded myself. So I funded the business on my own for the first 6 months. And post-maternity leave, I went back to work for a month. And it was very quickly realized it just wasn't the place for me. And quickly realized we were approached by investors 6 months after we started. And I was approached by the media.
It's
so
nice.
I had a couple of different articles in the media. And you realize, okay, there is a need for it. But it was a calculated risk. So jumping ship from corporate life into a startup world is not the easiest part of it, but it wasn't a crazy jump either, because it was something that was proven. For 6 months there was investors interested, it was in the media, there was a need out there, it was something that I knew would work. So I jumped ship around May 2012, we officially launched SukalMal.com in the UAE 2.5 years ago, and here I am 2.5 years later.
Mashallah. Well, you don't have any competitors, right?
We do. It's interesting you asked that, because when we launched in 2012, there were 7 other sites that came in probably around 6 months post.
After you?
After me. Right after.
Oh.
And but most of them have... Hey, I'm glad. Yeah, I think it's quite nice. It's quite a compliment there.
Do you ever feel, though, that some of the people are like, yeah, we want to invest in you. Let's talk. And then they're like, okay, what did you do there? Yeah, sure. What did you do there? And what about this? And then they're like, and then they go away. And, you know, they're technically a competitor, right? And sometimes even a competitor could be a strategic investor. So do you have any of that kind of issue popping up?
I've had my fair share. It's not always clean, if you want. I've had my fair share of people thinking they were very interested and, you know, trying to get as much information. But at the end of the day, the way I think about those things is if no matter what, it's execution after all. The idea can be there. You can even have your competitor's business plan. You can even have the cost. You can even have the names of every single person on the team. at the end of the day, it's about execution. And guess what? If they managed to overtake you, then they were just better at it. So whether or not they had your information, they would have done it anyway. So a lot of people come to me and say, you know what, don't tell anybody, this is my idea, but I don't want anybody to know about it. If you don't talk about it, nobody will know. And if you don't, nobody knows, nobody will ever invest in you. And if someone else picks up your idea and do it, they would have done it, no matter what. And they would have done it at a later stage where you would have lost even more money.
Financing the business is always challenging, especially when it's a startup. As you said, investors may say the business is worth nothing. And to you, equity is the most valuable thing on the planet. How do you part with it? How do you structure it? Do you use debt? Do you use equity? Do you just do revenue, sales, growth? Amberine's going to answer some of these tough finance questions in just a minute, so stay with us.
This is Eye on Careers, climbing the career ladder.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're listening to the story of Amberine Moussa, founder and CEO of SouqAlMal.com, one of the handful of cyberspace entrepreneurs, the dot-commers, cutting their teeth in this new industry that's exploding across the region. We saw it first with the Maktoub sale, which really started to catch some interest. We had Issan Jawad, who sold Zalia.com to, I think it was Dow Jones, if I'm not mistaken. What's Thomson Reuters, and so many more taking off now, and so she's sharing her insights into how she did it. Amberine, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thanks for having me, Shane.
It's good to be here. So if any one of you have missed the program so far, you can catch the podcast on DubaiEye1038.com/. on careers, and you have some really great stories there, from climbing Mount Everest to starting your own business. I think really, if you listen to our podcast, it's like getting an MBA. It would definitely give you some insights. You know, you have 100 people who've started businesses from scratch,
and it's free.
And it's free. You might learn a thing.
Imagine the investment. Imagine the returns on investment.
But you're investing your most valuable thing, your time.
Which is yourself.
So Amberine, you quit your job at MasterCard, started SouqAlMal.com, which is a website which compares financial products, right?
Absolutely. Banking products, credit cards, mortgages, personal loans. And what we're trying to do as well is bring a lot of transparency in the market.
Yeah, so you shouldn't get a credit card or you shouldn't pick up any financial product without going to SouqAlMal.com first and finding out, are you getting ripped off? Or are you getting a good deal?
Find your options, find all the offers that are out there as well. So don't just pick one without really comparing. That's what we say. Compare before you say, I do.
taste tester, is that? So, a lot of people struggle with, you know, how do I finance my business startup? Do I just start small and revenue, sales, growth? It's a sales growth driven strategy. Do I take on some debt? Do I sell my equity? If you sell equity, how much is it worth? What's your approach and advice on the financing question?
So the way we did it was we did bootstrap for the first couple of years. I'm a big fan of show track records before you try and sell equity. Try and fund the business yourself. One of the, probably the first question any investors will ask you when you approach them at any point of your business is, how much have you put in yourself? That just shows how much you really believe in your idea. Because if you don't want to put any money, which means you don't want to risk your own money, why would someone else put the money in your business? So what we did was, for the first 6 months, we funded it ourselves. So it was my own savings that went into it. But what I tried to do very, very early on was to show some sort of traction and some sort of revenue. Very small. It could be even $1,000. It doesn't matter. But what you want to show to the investors is this concept works. This concept, someone, one person, two people are ready to buy my product. They're ready and they believe that this product or this service is going to bring something to them. If you can prove that concept and you can actually show the concept works, your equity and your valuation is a very different story than it's just an idea on paper. Hey, why don't you come and take the risk with me? I don't want to put my own money and I don't even know whether someone's going to buy this. So put your own money in there. Show them that you do believe in your idea. Second part is show some track records. And you won't go for one round of funding. We've done two until now. We've gone one with angel investors, the first round, and the second one was $1.2 million from Hummingbird Ventures out of Belgium. What you need to show at every single time you decide to go fundraising, and by the way, we're going to another round of funding right now, is to show what did you do with the money you raised last time. What kind of track records have you shown? What kind of growth? Was it a 3x? Was it 2x? Was it a 4x? Because that gives investors as well an idea of what can they expect. So if you raise 1.2 million last year, what kind of progress have you made in the last 12 months? And therefore, if I give you more than 1.2 million, I give you, say, $3 million, what are you going to do with this $3 million? What kind of growth can I see? It de-risks the investment quite a bit when you are able to show progress between the different rounds of funding.
Right. And so it's basically, the whole formula is based on, I give you, you know, $10 today for whatever percent, and I can sell that in four to five years
for X amount of that number.
Which would be $30, three times is good.
A lot of investors, if you ask them, the average is, I mean, everybody varies. Some investors are in for the long term, some investors are in for the short term, and the short term one would normally look between 10 and 15x. So they would want to make 10 to 15 times their money. That's how
in
they
call
years? It. 4 or 5 years. It's the kind of the very, very high growth companies.
That's a lot, though, 10 times your money?
It's possible.
That's if they give you $1 million, they want $10 million out in 4 years. Well, that means your company has gone from, you know, it's $100 million company.
Don't forget that when you talk about percentage increase or even X increase, you're starting from a very, very, very low base. So the angel investors, when they come in the first round or the seed round that they call, they come in at a very, very low base. So 10X is, it wouldn't be the 10X you have on Facebook today, if that makes any sense. It's much bigger numbers. So. Right. And the company should be growing very, very fast in the first 3-4 years of incubation.
How much do you give the majority of your equity away? Do you only give a minority stake? How much of your equity should an entrepreneur say is reasonable to give out to raise money?
How much is reasonable is a hard answer, a question to answer. I think it's more around what the entrepreneur wants out of his business. Does he still want to keep control? If you still want to keep control for as long as you can, then you don't want to be giving too much away. But then it depends. I mean, one of the questions I get asked is, how do you value the company? At the end of the day, the value of your company, especially when it comes to an online business at an early stage, is what the market is ready to pay. So you go out there, you do your investment pitch, and you listen to how much people think your business is worth. I have an idea how much it's worth, but then if nobody wants to pay for it, then it's not worth that, right? It's the market rate.
The catch, though, is when you're small, say, you know, your revenues are, you know, $1 million or something like that. You know, you want an investment of $500,000. The amount of time you spend doing the investment pitch versus the amount of time you do doing sales, the amount of time doing sales could outstrip the money you get from the investment. So, you know, that's the other time investment, return on time that you get as the entrepreneur, right, when you're a startup.
You couldn't be more right. Looking for funding is a full-time job, and it takes every single minute of your day, it takes every single hour, because it's not just about doing the pitch. There's about finding out who do you want to talk to, and every single investor will request, you know, hours from your side to explain to them, and you start all over again every single time you meet someone and every single time you go through the pitch and you have to convince them. So yes, it does take away. I've even spoken to entrepreneurs who mentioned that the business stopped. It literally went to a halt during the time they were looking for funding. And so looking for funding when you're a bit bigger is easier than when you're very, very small, just because you're the only one doing it. So on top of everything that you've got to do, which is business development, operations, you've also now have to go after. So when you're looking for funding, yeah, the business is not running. So it's a tough call. The other options, I mean, if you don't want to give equity away, which there's a lot of entrepreneurs who are not ready to give equity away, and so you can keep bootstrapping. I mean, if you're in an industry that is very hard to compete in and competitors are not around and you're a bit of a monopoly and you're the first one in the market, maybe it is a way to bootstrap for longer than a year or two and keep going it and organically grow the business. We've come to a level now that, you know, we've seen an amazing organic growth in the last 2 years, but now it's time to invest. for us. The market's getting more competitive. It's time to grow. I mean, that's,
you still that's, have you don't have seven competitors anymore, though.
No, we don't.
There's like what, two or
there's a couple of them around. There's yeah,
one or two that survived.
That survived.
When you look at the ones who failed, what do you think the reason was that they failed?
I don't know much about them, but I think one of the things we got right is we got a team in quite early on. Being a one-man show for longer than a year is very, very, very tough. Because what happens when you're a one-man show, you can't even attract funding. If you can't attract funding, then you've got a cash flow problem. If you've got a cash flow problem, then you don't have a business anymore. So attracting team earlier on was one thing I think we did quite right, and was really talking about it, just talking about it. We were visible. We had a very strong PR, and I did not stop talking. If you meet anybody, the first thing I would talk about, whoever I met, wherever I met, was about the business, what I was trying to achieve and what I was trying to do, and where was the vision, and I would question people. What do you think? What do you think of that idea? Do you think that would work? Do you think that wouldn't work? What are your thoughts? And I kept gathering people, and in that way, I think we kind of grew quite quickly, organically, even through the media, and we got a lot of PR through getting the ball running.
So I think we're catching the clock is on here as we race into the hour. What is your final piece of advice for anybody who wants to take the plunge and start their own business?
Think very hard before you do it. It is a very tough road ahead, so you need to be prepared both financially and psychologically. If you do have a family, do think about the impact that's going to have on your family, especially if you're the breadwinner in the family.
That's the, so think about it. I think then you get analysis paralysis.
You know? No, I think about it in a way where... I wouldn't really say that, no. You can try. I'm not sure whether you're going to survive, but I think it is important to think through, just to be prepared for what's coming around. I think that's the most important thing. And when you become an entrepreneur, it does impact everybody around you. It's not just yourself, especially if you have a family. So, you know, talk about it to your family and friends and make sure that you're prepared for it. And the last part is, if you do decide to go for it, do not lose faith and do not lose the passion that you had. There will be low times. The only thing that's going to keep you going is a passion.
Well, Amberine, thank you so much for your time, and hopefully we can have you on again soon.
Always a pleasure.